Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. In this breathtaking cultural history filled with exclusive, never-before-revealed details, celebrated rock journalist Joel Selvin tells the definitive story of the Rolling Stones' infamous Altamont concert in San Francisco, the disastrous historic event that marked the end of the idealistic 1960s. In the annals of rock history, the Altamont Speedway Free Festival on December 6, 1969, has long been seen as the distorted twin of Woodstock, the day that shattered the 60s promise of peace and love when a concertgoer was killed by a member of the Hells Angels, the notorious biker club acting as security. While most people know of the events from the film Gimme Shelter, the whole story has remained buried in various accounts, rumor and myth, until now. Altamont explores rock's darkest day, a fiasco that began well before the climactic death of Meredith Hunter and continued beyond their infamous December night. Joel Selvin probes every aspect of the show, from the Stones' hastily planned tour preceding the concert to the bad acid that swept through the audience to other deaths that also occurred that evening, to capture the full scope of the tragedy and its aftermath. He also provides an in-depth look at the Grateful Dead's role in the events leading to Altamont, examining the band's behind-the-scenes presence in both arranging the show and hiring the Hells Angels as security. The product of 20 years of exhaustive research and dozens of interviews with many key players, including medical staff, Hells Angels members, the stage crew, and the musicians who were there, including 16 pages of color photos, Altamont is the ultimate account of the final event in rock's formative and most turbulent decade. The book that we're examining this evening is Altamont, the Rolling Stones, the Hells Angels, and the inside story of rock's darkest day, with my guest journalist and author, Joel Selvin. Welcome to the program, and thank you for agreeing to this interview, Joel Selvin.
Thanks, Dan. Good to be here.
Thank you very much. A little bit different book to look at today, but an incredible look back in history, and again, the darkest day in music's history, definitely. So let's ask this question: why a book about Altamont now? How did you become involved? Why did you want to become involved? Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I worked for most of what we might laughingly refer to as my adult life as the pop music critic of the San Francisco Chronicle. I started there in 1970, and the fumes, the aroma of Altamont was still in the air. So it's been a part of my lore all along. I came to know the musicians who played there, stagehands, people who attended the concert, and I heard these stories all those years. Why now? Well, let's just say that there's always time for a good story. This is a great story. I was not so convinced myself at first that it was a great story because it was such common material to me. I was so inured to the drama of it. But it was suggested that I look into this a little bit. And I went down to Monterey to visit with Rock Scully, the manager of the Grateful Dead. Rock told me the story of how Altamont started. It was a beautiful day. I hadn't seen Rock in ages. He looked great. We ate outside, and I drove home. It's about a 2.5-hour drive to San Francisco, and I drove home just feeling like I had a gold nugget in my pocket. This story was so good, and it just screamed, this is how a book opens. And about 2 months later, Rock died. He'd been sick that day. I didn't know it. Like I said, he looked so good, I was taking photographs of him. But it felt really at that point like these stories were evaporating and we had to do this right now or it was just going to not be possible. And it's certainly been the case since the book's been published. I think three or four people that I interviewed for the book have died since then.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, as you do in the book, take us back to, and you include this fantastic, the historical backdrop, but you have to take us back before 1969 to be able to explain the phenomena, the free concerts, the status musically and culturally of the Rolling Stones and the Grateful Dead and some of the bands, Woodstock itself, and the 60s counter-revolution. So tell us about Jan Wenner and the humble beginnings of Rolling Stone, and tell us who were the major players before we talk about the December 1969 Altamont concert.
So you're so right, Dan. There's just a huge convergence of social, political, cultural, and musical factors out there. And it was really difficult to lay that stuff out, the underpinnings of all this. That was the most challenging part of the book for me. You can't separate what happened on stage and in with the Hells Angels and Meredith Hunter and all that day with the culture of the time, the historical moment. Woodstock had been 3 months before, the moon landing, the Manson killings. The Chicago police shot Fred Hampton, the Black Panther, in his apartment that very week. It was just an extraordinary moment in our nation's history. You mentioned Jan Wenner. The Rolling Stone magazine was successful by that point. It was about a year and a half old. Jan was the publisher and founder. But it was largely a kind of underground music magazine, sort of a hit parade or a tiger beat for hippies until the Altamont thing challenged them journalistically. And they rose to the task. Their 20,000-word article cover headline, Let It Bleed, was really the first authentically accurate journalistic account of that day. The mainstream media just kicked that bucket down the hill. And I mean, the New York Times noted it as a joyous event, although one concert goer had been stabbed to death, but otherwise it was wonderful. And the local newspaper and radio had pretty much taken the same thing. It took Rolling Stone to really pull the curtain back on what the violence and negligence of that day. And in doing so, they really established themselves as a legitimate news magazine with that one issue.
Well, let's go back and tell it in the sequence so that we can understand how important Jan Wenner and the Rolling Stone magazine is to this story and is to history, period, and this murder case as well, as we will see. Let's talk about the bands and San Francisco. Now, San Francisco, you can tell it better than anyone. It was outside what I guess the rock music thought was New York and Los Angeles, and certainly San Francisco was not known nationwide, as you write about. So tell us about what happens with the San Francisco music scene and some of those bands, those players, and how do they get exposure before we talk about, again, this planned free festival here with the Stones and the Dead and some other bands.
Okay, I can do that. So in 1966 in San Francisco, there was a tremendous explosion of music based primarily on people who had been experimenting with the psychedelic drug LSD. There were a couple of dance halls in town, the Fillmore Auditorium and the Avalon Ballroom. They were putting on shows every week, and there was a whole variety of new-sounding rock music. Rock music that had never sounded like this before, with bands with funny names like Jefferson Airplane, Grateful Dead, Quicksilver Messenger Service, Big Brother and the Holding Company. And these bands were entirely unheard of outside of certain neighborhoods in San Francisco in 1966. But by 1967, the national news media had begun to find out about this hippie thing in San Francisco. In January of 67, some 100,000 people showed up at the polo fields in Golden Gate Park to listen to those bands. They did so without any violence, any strife, and the words which blew everybody's mind, that that many people could come together without any, you know, horrible incidences. They were compared to professional athletics, and the cops just couldn't believe what a different crowd it was from, say, like a football game. So that's like where the beginning of this whole San Francisco mythology began. It was no mythology. You know, these bands lived in the Haight-Ashbury near Golden Gate Park, and they would just, if the day was sunny and they felt like it, they'd take their gear out in the park and just start playing, and they didn't care who came or how, or if they got paid for it or not. And so this was like a new kind of renaissance of arts and culture on an electric, psychedelic level in California. And there was no internet at those times, so there was very little information outside of the immediate experience, right? You know, there weren't magazines, there weren't newspapers weren't covering it, the record industry was ignoring it. By the summer of 67, which the media called the Summer of Love, San Francisco was very much in everybody's focus. 100,000 kids descended on San Francisco that summer. The Jefferson Airplanes' second album, Surrealistic Pillow, was the biggest record of the summer. White Rabbit and Somebody Love were all over the airwaves. And the entire record industry sort of looked at San Francisco as like having a new answer. San Francisco and London became the sort of axis on which the rock scene revolved at that point. And by 2 years later, 1969, San Francisco was the center of the rock music universe. And Airplane was one of the biggest bands in the world. There was a Big Brother and the Holding Company had a number one album that year. All the great new bands, all the exciting new bands, Creedence Clearwater Revival, Santana, Sly and the Family Stone, those were all out of San Francisco. And it seemed like that, you know, there was just something so authentic about the music these hippies made that it resonated all around the world, and especially in London, where the music scene had always been very fashion conscious. You understand? I mean, they transmogrify music into style in England. And that's a very close relationship that they didn't quite understand from 5,000 miles away with what little faint hints of it they could get, wisps. You know, LSD was hard to come by in London, and light shows, they were just guessing at what was going on in San Francisco. There was very little back and forth until like 68. So the Rolling Stones in 1969 found themselves in a financial bind. They were broke. They had a manager who had bottlenecked all their royalties, and they were advised the only way they could get new money was to form a separate company that he wasn't involved in, tour the United States. Well, they hadn't been on tour in the United States for 3 years. The previous time, you know, they were like do a half-hour set at the end of an entire card of like one or two hit wonders doing three or four songs apiece and then get the hell out of Dodge, right? But in the ensuing 3 years, the rock scene had just changed so totally in the United States. I mean, like Led Zeppelin was the big act that year, that fall in October, touring behind their second album. And, you know, they had a 2.5 hour show with like a half hour drum solo. So the Rolling Stones, seeing the United States as a financial opportunity, they show up here to do this tour. And it gets complicated by many issues now, because they're trying to get into this new world of Woodstock rock, and there's so many public pronouncements that must be made. You know, you have to be in favor of free music, and you can't be seen as gouging your fans, even if you're asking $7.50, about twice what everybody else gets for concert tickets, right? So the Stones are trying to brush up against this San Francisco thing, and they start talking about this free concert right from the start. It's a thing at the time, free concerts. Jagger mentions it in a press conference in Los Angeles at the beginning of the tour. Once the tour starts and they find out how much impact they are really having, what size of opportunity this American tour really represents, then, you know, they start overtime on this idea of, well, let's do a concert movie and let's let's have a free concert, kind of our own Woodstock at the end to frame the movie. Now, they don't even really get this in gear until the end of the tour in New York, when they finally meet with Albert and David Maisel, the documentary filmmakers who would shoot the Madison Square Garden shows. But that's just the next to the last show on the tour. There's some footage, but they don't have a movie. The only way they're going to have a movie is if the Stones go through with this giant Woodstockian free concert in San Francisco. Well, behind the scenes, there's been a power struggle between the Stones front office and the Grateful Dead. And the Stones front office has taken control of the permit process with the parks, because it was Rock Scully's original idea to get a permit in the name of the Jefferson Airplane and Grateful Dead and bring the Stones on as like a surprise special guest announced like the day before the concert. Sort of pull one over on the city. But the Stones insisted, or their guys insisted on, you know, taking up the permit process themselves, and that ended any prospect of ever playing in San Francisco, because believe me, the mayor of San Francisco is not interested in hippies grooving in the park. So Jagger goes ahead the next day and announces at a New York press conference that they're going to have this free concert on December 6th, somewhere near San Francisco, we don't know where. As late as Tuesday, before the Saturday of the scheduled concert, they did not have a location. Then they stumble across this racetrack about 60 miles north of San Francisco called Sears Point, strike a deal with the guys that are running this track, and start building the stage and sound system. The next day, the corporate owners of the racetrack find out about this deal, and they call up the Stones lawyer, and they do not believe that the Stones are doing this movie for charity. And they happen to be in the film business themselves. They want a piece of the film, and they want a rental. And now the Stones refuse to budge. This is all about money. They aren't going to spend any money. They stalemate for 24 hours. The stage is going up at Sears Point. The sheriff is calling and telling them if they throw the concert here, they're all going to be arrested. And that's when this guy, Dick Carter, shows up, calls into the Stones lawyer's office. He's got a rundown speedway 60 miles east of San Francisco. And I mean, nowhere, past the suburbs, past Exurbia, past hundreds of acres of cow pasture, over a hill and in a valley on the edge of nowhere. Biggest crowd he's ever had, 6,000 for a demolition derby. It's almost out of business, but he says Stone's going to have his racetrack, Altamont Speedway, for free. He just wants the publicity. It's Thursday afternoon. The show's supposed to start on Saturday at noon. Rock Scully of the Grateful Dead gets in a helicopter with Michael Lang, the producer of Woodstock, not really sure what he's doing there. And they fly out over the Livermore Valley, where Altamont is, to take a look at it. As they dip down over this racetrack, Rock looks out there and he sees all this broken glass and these oil stains and these wrecked cars from the demolition derby. He's sitting there thinking, what the? And he hears Michael Lang say, oh, this is perfect. We can do it right here. So that's Thursday afternoon. They start moving the gear over from Sears Point, 60 miles away, by helicopter, by trucks that are driven by volunteers raised from the radio, come help the Stones concert. They put the stage together Friday night in the dark without many flashlights. And they're still plugging in equipment and wrapping cables when the band starts the next day at noon. There's 300,000 people there. In the middle of nowhere, no running water, no food concessions, no parking, no nothing. Just, boom, all these people showed up. The cops had no idea they were coming. It was a very bad setup for what happened, and what happened was what, you know, you would expect from something like that.
Let's go back a little bit to the relationship that the Rolling Stones had with the UK Hells Angels, and the difference, as you point out, between the UK Hells Angels and American California Hells Angels with Sonny Barger and crew. Tell us about the relationship the Dead had with the with the Hells Angels and their own guy that former Angel. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, the Angels were very much a part of the San Francisco rock scene. There were a presence at all the outdoor concerts, and in fact, at the Human Being, they guarded the electrical cord and handled the Lost Children. That was one of the big things that, you know, everybody was like, oh my God, the Hell's Angels. Well, you know, they partied with Ken Kesey, and Ken Kesey was the acid evangelist who provided the environment where the Grateful Dead started. So they all kind of knew each other, and they especially the San Francisco chapter. So when the concert was originally planned, Rock Scully said, "We got to invite the Angels. They're coming anyway, so we should invite them." So he took Sam Cutler, who was the Stones tour director, over to meet with some of the officers of the San Francisco chapter. And the first thing Pete Nell said was, "We're not cops. We're not going to do security. Oh, you know, we just want you to help out in any way you can. And, you know, we want you to feel welcome. And, you know, we want to make you feel welcome." And Pete says, "Well, we like beer." So Sam says, "Well, we'll buy you some beer." So he buys $500 worth of beer for the Hells Angels, and they come over. Keep in mind, if that concert had been held in San Francisco, which at that time was planned for, then the San Francisco chapter would have had jurisdiction. And that's a different thing altogether. Those guys were well known to the bands. They hung out backstage. They rode bikes together. They did business together. They were altogether a more civilized bunch of Hells Angels. And once it moved out of San Francisco and the San Francisco chapter lost jurisdiction, then it's a different ballgame. And in fact, most of the problems at Altamont were caused in the front of the stage by the San Jose chapter, which was a brand new chapter. It had been formed just that summer after a violent and vicious turf war with a group called the Gypsy Jokers. They wiped out the Gypsy Jokers and took like a few of the Gypsy Jokers and some of the South San Francisco Angels and formed this new San Jose chapter. And the San Jose chapter showed up and they were strung their bikes across the front of the stage because, well, they were going to buy tall stage from 300,000 people a mile away. And they knew that nobody would touch a Hells Angels bike. Well, that didn't prove to be the case, but the San Francisco Angels showed up. They were backstage. They were on stage. They weren't out in front with the pool cues. That was the San Jose guys. One of the most important jobs my book was to do was to treat the Hells Angels fairly at last, and to give those guys their names back, by the way, Dan. Because I look over all the reports and the reporting that came before, and it's just Hells Angels this and Hells Angels that. No, look, you know, these were people, and some of them were as aghast and appalled at what went on that day as anybody was. Some of them were extremely helpful to the doctors. Some of them were very helpful to the film crew. There's a lot of different experiences in Altamont for the Hells Angels, and you know, I wanted to be fair and honest and real about that. You know, like Paul Hibbets, they called him Animal. That was the guy who beat up Marty Ballin, the Jefferson Airplane vocalist. And I want, you know, he died a few years ago. He spent most of his life up in Alaska, but he was really apparently a very fun, nice guy. He was awfully intoxicated that day and real high. A lot of people were. There was, as you say, a lot of bad drugs going around. And he also did love the fist fight. So, you know, Animal was a bad flashpoint. And, yeah, he beat up Marty once in front of the film cameras and then a second time backstage. And then he beat up Rex Jackson, the Grateful Dead's roadie, who was the big, bad enforcer of that band. And when Rex got knocked out, everybody on stage knew that the Angels owned the stage. So some of them misbehaved. They were put in a bad position. But the Stones didn't have any idea what they were. The guys that pretended to be Hell's Angels in London that they had backstage at their free concert in Hyde Park, those were some candy-ass guys with clean jackets with their colors drawn in chalk. And they rode mopeds for crying out loud. They had no idea what a real California Hells Angel was any more than they knew what a real California hippie was or what a free concert was really like in the park. They just thought these things could be just manifested out of the ether. And Jagger in particular showed a total disregard for like practical realities.
Let's go to the day itself, and of course you talk about, you mentioned 300,000 people, and no one had even planned on these kinds of numbers, and certainly no one was prepared for any kinds of those numbers in any conceivable way whatsoever. What was the idea about the Golden Gate Park? Was there some confidence that the concert would be organized, and why was it not able to be originally? I mean, you had the other Speedway site, but why could it not conceivably been done at, say, Golden Gate Park.
So this whole thing starts late one night in London, about 2 months before, when Rock Scully of the Grateful Dead brings over a bunch of sensimilla, exotic marijuana grown in California, to Keith Richards. And they stay up all night smoking this grass and talking about, like, things that are going to happen, like the Stones' pending tour. And Rock tells Keith that he can fix it for the Stones to play a free concert in Golden Gate Park. He'd get a permit in the name of the Jefferson Airplane and Grateful Dead, and then announce the Stones like special surprise guest 24 hours before. And he was sure he could do that. I'm not sure what Keith thought Rock Scully was. You know, did Keith think that he put on a suit and went to an office in the morning? Rock Scully was a hippie. He was a fantastic guy. He was very, very smart and well-educated and highly verbal, but he was also like the attention deficit disorder poster child. He had taken so much LSD, his pupils had just brown blobs floating in buttermilk. And, you know, he's not exactly like the kind of person that, you know, works in the music business in London. So I don't know what Keith thought of Rock or what Rock really thought, because I know he also suggested that the Stones should do a concert at Stonehenge that night and also dreamed up taking the Stones to the Taj Mahal for a concert. So who knows? But the idea stuck with Keith. And when the Stones got to Los Angeles and started seeing all the tremendous excitement around both the Stones themselves and this free concert idea, then they contacted Rock and asked him to make good on his boast. And he showed up with Emmett Grogan of the Diggers. They were sort of like a Haight-Ashbury community group down in Hollywood and agreed to do this with him. Now, the permit thing came unglued, and that's another complicated backstage politics deal, because there was this guy in the Stones tour going by the name of John James. That wasn't his real name. The Stones didn't know that. He told the Stones he worked for Chrysler and could get them free cars. He told Chrysler he worked for the Stones and could get them an endorsement. And with that, he wriggled his way into sort of the touring party management. And he was a big shot. He was also in the witness protection program and seemed to know some cops. He brought some off-duty New York cops around to guard the Stones, and you know. And he stepped up at some point and said, "Oh, I can handle this permit thing." And this, he took over the idea of contacting. Now that just wasn't going to work. But Grateful Dead knew the system, and they knew how to tickle it. And they knew how to work with subterfuge. And they had the Parks Commission all lined up and all that. But the minute the word Rolling Stones came out, then the deal was done, and they were never going to get into Golden Gate Park. And this guy, James, just called up the mayor's office and, you know, tried to throw the Rolling Stones name around. That was not how it worked in San Francisco. So that was just over as soon as he picked it up. It was an interesting thing. That guy ended up being the signator on the contract with Altamont. He was never on the Stones' payroll. He had no official affiliation with them at all. And yet here he was, like, guaranteeing all this stuff. And when the legal thing went down, he was the guy holding the bag. No wonder he disappeared.
We can use this as an opportunity to talk about our sponsor, Blue Apron. Being a big health and natural food guy, I was very anxious to try the healthy and natural food and unique recipes from Blue Apron. First meal I tried was a summer vegetable and quinoa bowl with fairy tale eggplant, shishito peppers, and corn. I was impressed. The food tasted fantastic. The next meal I cooked was the Basque-style lamb and beef piperade. It was unbelievable taste, and I had cooked it myself. Gourmet meals cooked by me, so you know it was easy to follow the recipes, and the freshness of the ingredients was obvious. The smell and the taste helped make these meals delicious. For less than $10 per meal, Blue Apron delivers these and other seasonal recipes along with pre-portioned ingredients to make your own delicious home-cooked meals. Blue Apron knows that when you cook with incredible ingredients, you make incredible meals. So they set the highest quality standards for their community of artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, fisheries, and ranchers, humanely raised beef, free-range chicken, naturally raised pork, in regenerative farming practices for produce. Whether it's Japanese ramen noodles, wild-caught Alaskan salmon, or heirloom tomatoes, Blue Apron is bringing you the very best. New recipes are created weekly and are not repeated within the year, so you can choose your meals from a variety of recipes or let Blue Apron's culinary team surprise you. Customize your recipes each week based on your preferences. Choose delivery options to fit your needs. There's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want them. Each meal comes with a step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe and pre-portioned ingredients and can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. Check out this week's menu and get your first three meals absolutely free along with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/murder. You will love how good it feels, how good it tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron, so go to blueapron.com/murder. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. Now, when we last left off, Joel, I want you to, for our audience, to set up, as you very vividly do in your book, the day itself and, again, the confluence of and convergence of events and circumstances that are Altamont that day, including, as you said, the lack of preparation. But talk about the bad LSD. And to be fair as well, as you do in the book, these San Jose guys with the pool cues, these prospects in this new chapter were out of control, and there was more than a hint of violence right from early on, we'll say. So take us back to that day and some of the things that even the hippies were seeing, armed with only peace symbols.
The way that chapter opens, because I chose to start the concert section of the book at the police station, and the 26-year-old acting watch commander, and the guy who caught the phone call on the way out of the office at 8 in the morning, was asked if he knows anything about a concert at the Altamont Speedway with the Rolling Stones, and it means nothing to him. And he makes a note of it and passes the note off to the acting watch commander because he's going home and he doesn't know who the Rolling Stones are. So that's where we go out there at the beginning. It was just, it just dropped on that end of the world. And yes, Dan, you're still right. From the very onset, there was blood on the ground and violence. The crowd was in a bad mood. The conditions were terrible. And the first band of the day, Santana, got things going. But somewhere in the middle of their first song, a concert goer jumped up on this 4-foot-tall stage and ran across the stage, chased by 3 or 4 Hell's Angels, who caught up with him on stage right in front of the keyboard player and beat the kid to a pulp. The band was horrified. They'd never seen anything like it. The stage was overcrowded with like 200 people and very menacing Hell's Angels right over your shoulder. The next act was Jefferson Airplane. That's when Animal cold cocked Marty Balin. I mean, nobody had ever seen that happen before. Musician beat up on stage during a set. That was just incredibly shocking. And here to stop the concert, Paul Kantner of the Jefferson Airplane, and get into a shouting match with Sweet William Fritch at the San Francisco chapter, who was on stage. Those guys knew each other. Kantner couldn't believe what was happening. Bill Laudner, the road manager from the Jefferson Airplane, used to ride bikes with those guys. He knew every one of them that were on stage from the San Francisco chapter. He couldn't believe what was happening. The pool cues were out in front, and all through Santana's set, all through the Airplane set, any perceived and infraction, crimes real and imagined, were punished. The doctors told me they were surprised how many girls they were stitching up with lacerations and abrasions. These guys were pumped up on Reds, which is a sleeping pill. They tend to frustrate people. So they're known as the anger pill, and really bad LSD. LSD that has been cut with strychnine or methamphetamine over stimulants. In 1967, the Summer of Love, people who made LSD were missionaries. They were zealots, and those chemists went to great lengths to make sure that those compounds were stable. 2 years later, it evolved into a criminal enterprise, and the chemists were just throwing anything in there that made it work. Methamphetamine added to LSD would overstimulate the users, causes all kinds of side effects, I guess you'd call them side effects. And there was a lot of drinking going on. Now, in the Summer Love, again, drinking and psychedelics didn't mix. Now, here we're at Altamont, people are guzzling Red Mountain wine. And the medical symptoms of mixing psychedelics and alcohol are erratic behavior and violent outbursts. We got a lot of that. So you have all this, and the psychiatrists, I thought the psychiatrists working in the bummer tent, they were overwhelmed from the minute they opened for business. They couldn't believe it, to what they were seeing. And then these guys were from San Francisco. They weren't babes in the woods. But this was just an extraordinary, outrageous thing that was going on right from the start, beyond the pale. And they worried, since they knew how remote their tent was, how there were no stage announcements about its existence or any signage pointing the way, that they were only seeing the tip, 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 tip of what was going on out there. So what we're talking about is probably tens of thousands of people on drugs.
What can you explain for our audience, the 300,000 people show up, but what is the phenomena at that time? Because it always wasn't like that, it maybe isn't like that now, that somebody would want to rush the stage. Was there actually people rushing the stage, or was there a couple things going on in terms of people pushing from behind? Were some people trapped against
their will? Yeah, there was no,
against
there was
their
no
will
room.
In them?
No room down front. Gil Marcus, who's a Rolling Stone reporter, was there that day, and he told me that at one point, standing up down front, he got off his leg onto one leg, and he couldn't get his leg back down because the crowd was so tightly crushed together. But he stood there on one leg trying to get his leg down. Nobody would help him or cut him a break. So the crowded conditions, the hostile nature of the crowd, and the drugs, the weather. It was 37 the night before, very cold, and warmed up to the low 70s, really unseasonably warm. And then at the end of the day, after Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, and 2 hours before the Stones came on after dark, 40-mile-an-hour winds whipped through the place, and the temperature dropped 20 degrees, and then it turned dark, and Stones came on, and all hell broke loose.
Let's talk about Patty Brendehoft and her boyfriend Meredith Hunter, and he's black, and she's white. And what did they notice, according to her later, what did they notice about the Angels and their attitude about a black and white couple? We're talking 1969.
Patty was I'm from Berkeley, where, you know, the most progressive community in the country at that point. Patty was always aware of the kind of looks she got when she was out with Meredith. But I don't have to take her word for it. Tony Funches was the Stones' bodyguard. He was on stage all day. He's a 6'8", 285-pound guy with a 34-inch waist, a former Air Force boxing champion. And when one of the couple of the Hell's Angels gave him some trouble earlier in the morning, he took them both backstage and broke his hand on their faces. So nobody messed with Tony the rest of the day. And you can see pictures of Tony because he's taller than everybody else, and he just stands out in the crowd. And he said, oh, yeah, he saw him. Meredith was wearing a bright green suit. He was dressed out to the max. And Patty was a gorgeous 17-year-old blonde girl. Tony saw him from the stage, and he saw the Angels see him too.
Now let's talk about the Stones and the delay. You talked about the weather changing and the mood and increasingly got worse, and again, without any kind of services at all, that this was just increasing and obvious chaos to almost everybody. At first, they might not have been able to see it. So let's talk about the stones and their delay and why there was a delay and what their attitude was, despite what they, at least they could hear and were told about the angels.
So the Stones always claim that it's bass player Bill Wyman showing up late that caused them to go on when they did. But that's bull. They weren't going to go on until it was dark. They were making a movie. That's what this was all about. They were going to film all the other acts in the daytime, and they were going to be the one act in the nighttime. Why? Because stars come out at night. So that's what that was about. They were never going on before dark. They were outrageous with making audiences wait on that tour. They didn't care when they went on. I saw the second show in Los Angeles before them on that tour, and they didn't come on until 4 in the morning. They didn't want to follow Ike and Tina Turner, who had been put on a little too good a show. That's not really why the Stones didn't go on until then. They went on at dark because...
What was the state of their awareness before they went on in terms of potential danger and some of that? You talk about in the book, the naked fat guy was the teeth knocked out. So there were some people out of control and other people who were also out of control exerting some a good beating on a man like that.
So they walked in from the helicopter. Richards had spent the night there, pretty much sequestered in his backstage dressing room, little trailer. But the rest of the Stones walked in through the chaos and they saw and witnessed what was going on, even if they didn't see any immediate like beatings or anything. But they got back there, and people such as Michelle Phelps and the Mamas and Papas who had been there all day told them what was going on. Then they met the angels, Sonny Barger of the Oakland chapter, and his guys showed up about 5 o'clock just before sunset, drove right all the way through the crowd. They were brought back and introduced to the Stones. Sonny thought they were a bunch of sissies. They certainly had plenty of angels around them, acting as guards and escorts and stuff like that. And you can see in the movie when they push through the crowd to get to the stage, that it's quite an intimidating scene. There's easily 200 people on the stage, and many, many, many large and violent-looking, menacing figures, all crowded around the band. And as you watch the movie, you can tell, the angels just marauded throughout that set. What happened was the third song of this set was Sympathy for the Devil, and Sonny Barger of the Oakland chapter saw some kid in the audience jumping up and down on a motorcycle and shorting out the battery and setting a fire, and he dashed into the audience to knock the kid off the bike and put out the fire. Well, all the other angels saw Barger, and they just followed. They didn't know what he was doing. They just followed him into the crowd and just started laying waste to the front row. And Jagger stops the band and starts pleading with the audience, brothers and sisters, what are we fighting for? But it's just bloodlust now. And they start the second, they finish the Sympathy of the Devil, they start the next song. They have problems with that. They started a second time, and that's when Meredith Hunter pushes his way to the front of the stage and gets a Hell's Angel shoving him back down. And then he goes back up to get in that guy's face. 4 or 5 angels tackle him from behind, and they start stomping him and kicking him. He gets loose from them and pulls out a gun. That's when Alan Pissarro, San Jose Hell's Angel, standing nearby, reaches down to his ankle where he's got a knife in his sheath and does a pirouette and jumps on Hunter, stabs him in the neck, and as they fall to the ground together, stabs him 4 more times. The angels swarm over him, and Pissarro is separated from Hunter, and the angels continue to stomp and kick Hunter and stand on him, and finally leave him alone. A couple of concertgoers manage to get him up and carry him to the lip of the stage, and they put him on the stage. Everybody saw him, everybody. I talked to people on that stage, and they all saw this. It didn't happen long. because the angels just came swarming over this and pushed the body back into the audience. A young doctor, intern named Dr. Robert Hyatt, had answered the call for the doctor to the stage, happened to be standing there, and he said his arms would hurt for the next week, but he carried Hunter backstage to the medical tent. And Dr. Fine, the head of medical there, took a look at Hunter, realized the nature of his wounds, clearly possibly mortal, and put another doctor on the reviving him, and went to try and get a helicopter to medevac. Did never find anybody in charge or anybody that would give him the permission to use the helicopter. So he called the ambulance, and Hunter died waiting for the ambulance. Now, the Stones, what? Meanwhile, on stage, they don't know what to do. They've just seen this body, and the whole concert just falls apart, right? And so the young guy, Mick Taylor, new guitarist, he says, let's play the new one. And Jagger says, okay. Well, look, Tuesday, they'd been in Alabama recording. And Saturday, at that point, after Meredith Hunter's murder, they publicly debut their new song, Brown Sugar. And let me tell you, the concert comes back together in an instant. I've heard these 16-track mixes that Bob Matthews of the Grateful Dead recorded that day. He played them for me in his living room. It's the only place you can hear them. And, the Stones played great. Then the beatings continued, and by another sort of weird trick of fate, instead of being blinded by spotlights, as most performers are on stage, the spotlights never showed up. So the only light they had at Altamont was 50,000 watts of backlight. And they used all of it. And it made the front rows entirely illuminated to the stage. So all these beatings that had taken place, the Stones were seeing them in full living color, which they're not used to. And they powered through another hour of the show after Hunter's death. And they never stop again. They just keep going. There's problems, there's trying to climb on stage, and they just play their butts off. Charlie Watts and Bill Wyman, they have it locked down, and Keith Richards and Mick Taylor, their guitars are grinding together like ears, and Jagger, he's singing this really convincing, committed thing, you know, like really, like he means it, not that loopy characterizations that he sometimes gets into. So, they were terrified. They were surrounded by all these menacing figures. They were witnessing all these beatings. They couldn't figure out anything to do but play the show and get the hell out of there. And where'd they go? They hid in the music. They buried themselves in the music. They that's what musicians do. It's you know, kind of heroic.
There was a more than... essentially a threat from the angels that they weren't going to get off that stage. Richard was quite vocal and had said some things, and they both, maybe Richard's a little more wholeheartedly, had said, well, we're going to quit, we're going to stop. Wasn't there more than an implied threat that they better continue?
I don't think there was ever anybody who was going to take that seriously. The idea of stopping and walking off in the middle of a set on 300,000 people in pitch black out in this cow pasture, didn't seem like a really safe, secure idea to anybody. So I think Keith really was brave, bantam rooster. Hey, those cats, stop that, or we're not going to play. With these huge guys that could break him in half, standing, a step away from him. I mean, that was definitely some gutsy stuff, boy. Cojones, they say. And Jagger, I got to give Jagger credit for really trying to, put oil on troubled waters and really, reaching into the audience and trying to relate and get these people to wise up and be with them. And that goes on all through the set. At the end, when he says goodbye, he says, well, we had some troubles, but it's been a good time.
Yeah.
That isn't in the movie, though, The movie's not a very accurate portrayal of the event, oddly enough.
You talk about really a couple essential characters you introduce, Paul David Cox and Baird Bryant. So explain who these two people are and their role at Altamont.
Paul David Cox was one of the concertgoers who carried Hunter to the stage. But more importantly, He was an anonymous caller to Rolling Stone magazine who gave an incredible first-person account of Hunter's beating and killing. It became the lead section of the Rolling Stone cover article, and it's just the sort of thing news magazines dream for. You just get dropped right in the middle of the action. So subsequently, of course, he was an important witness in the trial, and that's when he disappeared. He was reluctant to reveal his name to Rolling Stone, and I believe he's only identified by a single name. And, in fact, this attorney had a hard time finding out who he was, and then when they did find him and he ran away, they only found him just a few days before before he was supposed to testify. Baird Bryant was the cinematographer who actually captured the Hunter assault on film. He didn't know it at the time. He was lying in a prone position on the top of a van behind the stage, shooting the whole on-stage action. Eric Sarnon was also on stage with a camera and saw the scuffle. Both Brian and Sarnon hit their zoom button, but Eric Sarnon hit the wrong way, so he zoomed back. Bryant hit the right one and zoomed in. Now, he never knew what he got on film or even if he'd seen anything. He just sort of followed his instinct until the film was developed and they saw the dailies and realized that, yes, indeed, they had the killing on camera. Baird Bryant was an interesting guy, too, by the way. That cinematographer that shot the cemetery scene at Easy Rider has
right.
a long background in bohemian life in Paris.
Now, you talk about the exit. You alluded to the helicopter when we're looking for a helicopter to be able to fly Meredith Hunter to hospital. It was reserved, and nobody could. He said, well, I got to get authorization, and nobody could find anybody to authorize the helicopter, so that's why the ambulance was called, and he died as a result. So other people jump into copters, other bands, they leave, they jump into crowded copters, and they get out of there. What is the – you talk about – a person drowning, but more importantly, you introduce a guy named McDonald. So quickly talk about the other crazy deaths that occurred at Altamont.
Jim McDonald, yeah. Private investigator Scott Dudek found Jim. And he's a surfer, stoner, fireman down in Santa Cruz. And he remembered every ride that he got hitchhiking to the show. He met some friends. He got high on acid. He had a great time. Split up with his friends, and as he's leaving, he's walking out through this dark field. He sees this car sort of moving slowly, and he says, hey, you know, give me a ride. They go, where are you going? He goes, well, I'm going to Santa Cruz. They go, we're going to San Francisco. He says, oh, that'd be good. So they open the back door and say, oh, there's room for one more. He gets in, and he's tacking. There's a couple guys in the back seat. There's a young gal and a baby in the front, and another couple guys driving and sitting up in front. And they don't all know each other. They're all sort of like, you know, ride grouping up, and they're going through the crowd very slowly. They get up to the highway. Traffic's still crowded, so they decide to pull over and make a fire. And Jim has a blanket because he remembered it gets cold up there. He'd been hitchhiking through there. And he gets this blanket out of his knapsack, and he pulls it around his shoulders and his fists and sort of tugs it tightly together. And the next thing he knows, some guy is shaking his shoulder, and he hears the guy say, hey, this one's still alive. Some acid-crazed concert goer stole in a car under the assumption or belief that he was being chased by Hell's Angels, drove it through the exiting crowd at speeds up to 60 miles an hour, the highway patrol figures. Gets to the top of the hill, launches, crashes down on this campfire, kills two people that McDonald's sitting next to, seriously injures the young mother. And McDonald, man, he's pulled out of there by a highway patrol medevac. He dies in the helicopter and has to be brought back to life in the emergency room where he's flatlined. His mother comes up to hand her his possessions, and he's got this blanket, right? And on one side of the blanket, his body is outlined in squirts of blood, and the other side is a tire track.
Yeah, well. Now, we missed one little profound point, so I'll just go backwards just a little bit. When Meredith Hunter is stomped, and Meredith Hunter has been stabbed with a big, large knife, and there are people go to help him. Paul Cox, another concert goer. And what did the angels say to those people and to Patty about Meredith Hunter lying on the ground?
Yeah, leave him alone. He's going to die. Don't cry over him. He's not worth it. Yeah. Those are some bad guys. On the other hand, you know, you pull a gun in the crowd, that's a very difficult decision to make. And my detective, Scott Budak, who was a former Alameda County Sheriff's homicide investigator who worked on this case, he said if Alan Passaro wasn't Hell's Angel, he'd probably be considered a hero. So, and keep in mind, Passaro was acquitted. He found not guilty because of Hunter pulling a gun. Who knows whether he shot it or not? Who knows who he intended to shoot? Certainly from all accounts and from the film, you know, it looks like he pulled it in self-defense, but you know, at that point, you've updates in the game, and you know that what happened happened.
Now, how does it come to?
You notice I refused to call it a murder. It wasn't a murder.
Right.
It was a killing.
Now, there's the story that you tell, and there's a story that Jan Wenner and Rolling Stone, you know, break out of their relative obscurity and into national headlines and importance. But tell us, it was amazing and surprising. Tell us what the reaction is first in the New York Times and other, the Examiner and other papers. How do they report on what everyone else saw? What was the quite different story in the news the next day and the following day?
Yeah, it was crazy. Yeah, 300,000 say it with music was the Sunday newspaper headline in San Francisco. The guy went on to go on great length about how what a groovy time was had, and young people were really getting together. Oh, yeah, some guy was stabbed to death, but really it was a wonderful day in the sun. And the New York Times pretty much said the same thing, much shorter, because, of course, you know, it was happening out on the West Coast. But they noted the death of a concert goer in what was otherwise a fine, you know, Woodstock-like festival. That was the accepted myth at that point. The Woodstock myth was so large that the media was the mainstream media, who were, you know, not hip or with it or at all, but they just read it as like, oh yeah, somebody died, but it was another Woodstock, you know. Yeah, it took Rolling Stone to divulge the real intent of that, and I mean, they were so far ahead of the curve, the homicide investigators had to come over and get an advanced copy of the magazine to figure out what their case was almost about.
We just alluded to it, but tell us where Rolling Stone really succeeded and had a coup in terms of witnesses that really opened up the story for him and revealed the truth about what actually happened.
Well, the truth that actually happened. The Rolling Stones themselves have never really opened up to it. Their whole attitude is that the Grateful Dead and Hell's Angels are responsible for this. I ran into Ronnie Snyder in Los Angeles a couple weeks ago. He was the producer of the tour. He pretty much said the same thing. They went through with it because the Dead insisted on it. So I don't think that just doesn't make any sense, and it doesn't fit with the facts. What fits with the facts is you know, a really dangerous, volatile cocktail of greed and innocence, and the Stones, I think, were guilty of lots of both of those, and that's what happened.
What I meant was, what was the key for Rolling Stone magazine in terms of how they broke this? What was their coup in terms of how they discovered the truth about what happened, as opposed to what was being reported as some, you know, further love-in that had occurred at 300,000 people?
Rolling Stone put a team of 11 reporters on it. These were hit guys. They were from the rock scene, went square, old-time newspaper reporters. They saturated the story. It's 20,000 words. Covers pretty much everything that's in my book almost, and did it a week afterwards. It's an extraordinary piece of journalism. They were supervised by managing editor John Burks, who was a veteran of Newsweek, so he knew what News Magazine stuff was. He wasn't just an underground newspaper guy that had never had a tough breaking story before. But they did a great job.
Now, with this as well, like you say, the police are playing catch up. So with this, they have now an idea of who they may question because based on this, and everybody's also awaiting a film from a cinematographer that, as you write in the book, she was accidentally dosed on acid and spent about 8 hours underneath the bleachers and then rallied and got some amazing footage. So tell us about this fight to who is going to be able to see the footage first. Tell us, it's a profound story, the Stones, the Angels, and the police. Who gets to see the film and how everybody reacts differently?
The filmmakers were very protective of their dailies. They hid them. They got out of town with the film before anybody noticed they were gone, and they took them straight from the lab to a place out in Malibu where a director not associated with the project lived. They were really careful to find out what they had before they found out before they showed anybody, and they brought them up to San Francisco about a week and a half later, they had a screening at Francis Coppola's American Zoetrope Studio for the two district attorneys, who then took the footage and had blow-up stills made from it. They didn't know what they saw. They couldn't identify the guy. They didn't know what to do with what they had. The guys who were investigating it couldn't figure out where to go with this. They first ran down to L.A. and chased some rabbit hole down there. Rolling Stone magazine was more help than anything. I mean, they didn't seem to be in any hurry to get out to the track. They didn't go out that night because of the traffic. They didn't really go out till Monday, 2 days later. It was a weird investigation. It took them 3 months to find Pissarro. He'd been in custody since Tuesday after the concert. On another charge, obviously.
And they didn't even talk to Patty for a week, didn't they?
Well, they talked to Patty on Monday.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, eventually, again, it's not easy because the Angels aren't going to identify. They put a couple Angels that they suspected through polygraphs, which led them to believe that they knew something, but nobody was going to give up this name. But eventually, as you mentioned, Pissarro gets charged. He's already in jail on a pretty heavy 2-10 already. It's crucial because the film and the people who did the film there are crucial witnesses, reluctant witnesses that are set for this trial here that maybe nobody was anxious to put these people in front at a court, but really they do. So
people who are very worried about Angels are very known for intimidating witnesses. It was widely presumed that Pissarro was going to go down for this, since it's obvious that he did it. George Walker was the brilliant defense attorney the Angels hired. He was San Francisco's first prominent African-American attorney and also integrated the basketball team at UC Berkeley as an All-American after the war, integrated the Air Force, 361 bomber missions. Quite a guy, an amazing guy. And he played the Johnny Cochran thing long before Johnny Cochran. Made sure that Pissarro got an entirely all-white jury, which is not easy to do in Oakland, California, immediately undermined almost every witness the prosecution brought. And then especially the damning piece of film footage that the prosecution thought would show that Pissarro killed Hunter. And actually what it turned out, it showed the jury was that Hunter pulled a gun. So George Walker is still alive, 92, is a brilliant, wonderful man, and he saw this all the way. He said he never thought he would lose it.
Mm-hmm. Now, you chronicle in this book as well that disaster seems to happen. I mean, obviously, the love peace generation failed, or it seemed, and this was a concert that many have spoken about, was that catalyst or that end of that dream. But bad luck and extremely bad luck follows a lot of these people, bands and managers and all kinds of people. So tell us a little bit about the litany of disaster that followed the people that were involved in Altamont.
Oh, that's such a, I mean, I don't want to drill too down, but, you know, the airplane was splintered within a few months. The stones were never the same. The dead were never the same. The angels were never the same. Harry the Tramp committed suicide. The dead's manager absconded with all their money. The stones went into a dark period of lawsuits and drugs. I mean, oh no, it was a terrible tailspin. How are we doing on time?
We're just almost going to wrap up. I just wanted to ask you what this. At the end of this, what, if anything, that you didn't set out to unlock or determine, is there anything at the end of this that was surprising to you that you did, were able to conclude from all this research and this investigation into Altamont?
So there was no, like, big new discovery. Like, I knew about the vehicular manslaughter, even if Scott Dudek didn't. I thoroughly read up on it. So there was no big, like, aha thing. But the extraordinary detail, almost granular, of how heedless and irresponsible and violent and dark this was, that came as a surprise to me. And the power and the propulsive nature of this narrative, that surprised me too. It's more not any one detail, but the whole accumulation.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Joel, for coming on, and I want to tell people, too, with this Altamont, the Rolling Stones, the Hell's Angels, and the Inside Story of Rock's Darkest Day, there's some fascinating photos in this, incredible photos, and the incredible history backdrop that you present here. As your role as a rock journalist is just a fascinating step backwards in history. And I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about Altamont. It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much, Joel Selvin.
Thanks, Dan. Take care.
You too. Good night.